Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We're going to belay the usual opening so we can jump right into our program. But of course, you know where we are and when we are and how we are, and all the information is available at richarddugan.com. You know, there are times when I have the opportunity of meeting guests and talking with them about their work, and it's always been gratifying. I don't think there's been one interview that I have done in over 7 years of doing this program, let alone over 35 years of interviewing in general, that I haven't come across interviews. I think back to maybe the early 1980s when I was early in my career, and it was probably one of the worst interviews. Could have been better, but I was having to multitask, but even back then. And I interviewed a proctologist. A very interesting interview, to say the least. I don't have the tape anymore, and I think that's probably for the better. However, today is a big exception to the rule, because this is going to be a fun interview. I think you're going to enjoy this. And I think that you're going to enjoy our author, Colleen Miller. She's written a fascinating little book, and it's called Crash the Symbols in Hell. Crash Those Symbols in Hell, Lorraine Grisky. It is basically, as Colleen puts it, mining my childhood for truth, freedom, justice in the America. No, truth, freedom, and laughter. And Colleen, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, but what do I have to do with a proctologist?
Absolutely nothing, but I find it fascinating. I think it would have been kind of cute. Mining my childhood for truth, justice, and the American way. And then cross that out for truth, freedom, and laughter, which I think is a whole lot more fun than truth, justice, and the American way. Not that I have any...
Well, but Superman did have a good gig.
He did. He absolutely did. He must have had a good launderer. Because he managed to keep his cape clean.
Well, did you ever safety pin a bat?
I did that. Ruined many of my. I never jumped off the garage, but I ruined many of my mother's towels, to her chagrin.
Well, yeah, because you had to be like Superman. I mean, he's laid out there flat, and he's flying away, and his arms are out of. Yeah, I did it off the. Well, it was the. Yeah, the carport.
Well, one of the things I want to talk about, and you've kind of started us on our way telling stories here, has to do with telling those stories of our lives, our childhood, maybe even early adolescence and young adulthood as well, and some of the lessons that we learned. And, I mean, I could start just rambling through my brain some of the images of growing up with a brother and four sisters in a small three-bedroom. And I am not kidding you. The house could not have been more than 1,200 square feet, if that.
Oh, my.
Three bedrooms, one bathroom. And yet my parents did one heck of a job. I will say they made a great design move. The kitchen and the dining room were separate rooms. They each had four walls. They ended up putting in two arched walkways, one at either end of the kitchen on the same wall, so you could walk in circles, you know, kind of thing. And then they took the wall out, if I'm remembering correctly, maybe I'm not, that had a doorway into the living room. So, I mean, it just opened everything up. It was great. But the thing about telling stories is more about, it's kind of like... some of the series that we're doing now on mythology. one of the things that has struck me, and I had a good friend share this thought with me, is that in particular, Star Trek Next Generation, this was back in the 90s, 80s and 90s, was our modern-day mythology as he saw it. And I thought, well, wouldn't our own stories maybe kind of fill that same bill? Because when you read a story about the gods or just about some mythological story, it isn't just a story. There's a moral in there somewhere. There's a lesson to be learned. Going back to how we started out the program with Superman, when you watch those episodes, there was usually a moral. It was a general moral throughout the series, but nonetheless, maybe even that specific series, you might be able to pick out the moral to the story. Aesop's Fables is another one as well. So when you compile this work, I mean, you must have had hundreds, literally, of stories to choose from. How did you decide which ones that you were going to put into the book, or is there a part two and a part three coming?
Well, I only did my stories from when I was first memories of being three until I was 12. And I don't know if there are going to be more parts. I'm writing another book, but that's my mother's stories from growing up on a homestead when she was a young girl. So I don't know what happens next, but the way you make a good point, we have a lot of stories about our childhood. And my point in writing these stories was asking myself, what are the pivotal stories that really formed my life and my definition of myself and my childhood? Because I believe that what's important about the stories are not only the anecdotal, humorous part of it. They're all my. I tried to make my stories funny because that's what I find most important in the world is being able to laugh. But what are the ones that what did you make those events mean about you and the world, and how did you define yourself in accordance with those events? So those were the pivotal events of my life, and what I wanted to do was not only entertain people, but remind them of their pivotal moments, those moments that shaped them into the adults they are now. What I find in my work now and working with people is that what they made those events mean is very important to the overall well-being in their lives, and going back and looking at those and perhaps taking a second look and redefining themselves in accordance with those events can free you up from the onus. If you've had an event in your childhood that makes you feel badly about yourself, you may determine that you're really not a worthwhile person and live within that, even though you don't know you believe that. It's running your life. So in my work with people now, I help them find those stories, clear the misunderstandings around them, and redefine themselves in terms of who they really say they are and who they want to be. So in writing my stories, that's what happened for me.
I healed.
Mm-hmm. I healed the pain of my childhood through writing those stories.
And that's something that I know that many people have been doing for a long, long time. I mean, I started back in the early 80s. I was in my early 20s, and I was going through these different programs, these intensives that were being made offered back then. And of course, they were always telling you kind of the same thing. The way that they went about it, of course, was maybe perceived a little abrasive, just any number of different things you might want to use to describe them. But nonetheless, they were there, and it's like, this is why you are the way you are, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you need to back then, it was blame the parents. And not too long after that, in the late 80s, early 90s, they began to shift away from blaming the parents anymore to us taking responsibility, dirty word, for our lives. That, okay, so your parents, this is what they did. All right, what are you going to do? You can't hold them accountable any longer. And I have to say, I tend to agree with this particular point, and I'd like your take on it. They did the best they could with what they had at the time.
I'll take it. I'll take it a step further than that. My belief, my personal philosophy, is that we choose our parents. We choose our parents, and they choose us. So they may not be the parents you would have liked them to be, but they were the parents you got, and they were the parents you chose for the lessons that you came here to learn. I believe we are co-creating our lives every minute of every day, and part of the co-creation is the cast of characters with whom we surround ourselves. So those parents were pivotal to the lessons we came to learn. Were they my ideal parents? Finally, I think they were, because I finally understand what I came here to learn from them. But during the time I was growing up, I sure as heck wished I'd had, you know, the good witch and not the bad witch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the way we look
at it. And the other thing that I think writing your stories and reexamining your childhood, not just from that anecdotal stories you always told, but from an exploratory place of what did I make that mean and how did I define those people? When I wrote these stories, I had to take a really good look at how I had limited the definition of my parents from my childish perceptions of them. And going back and reexamining it, I saw what you said. I saw that these weren't gods that I had elevated them to. They were simple people who did the very best they knew to do with what they knew at the time. That's all they knew at the time. I am a much better grandmother than I was a mother because I know more.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the best mother I knew to be, but if you talk to my children, they will give you a laundry list of things I did wrong. And I know better now, so I do better. But
yeah.
I didn't know, and I did the best I could, and I was trying very hard during the time I was raising children to be conscious, because that was a big deal. My parents were just trying to survive.
Yeah.
And it's a completely different perspective, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it would be like blaming Bill Gates for Windows 8 and all of its problems, but somehow tying it going back to Windows 3.1, you know, which I remember and so forth. It's like we evolve, we change, we grow, we move forward, and it's up to us as individuals to choose to do that. And it's also up to us as individuals, from what I am understanding, that we let go of the blame game. Stop playing the victim. I'm trying to think now of the context of this, but it's along the lines we went through phases back in the 80s and 90s into the 21st century when it came to this kind of conversation like we're having now in terms of dealing with our own personal issues and those kinds of things. Those were just phases that we went through to get to where we are today, if I'm gathering correctly. And I think storytelling, though stories were told during those intensives that I went through, they weren't quite the same kinds of things. But they were trying to make the shift away from, you know, blaming them. And it's not them versus us or them versus me. It's just me.
Yeah.
And I've made those choices. And I can choose to stay where I am or I can choose to be somewhere else. I think one of the most frustrating phrases that I learned in one of these groups was this. If you didn't want to be here in the intensive, you wouldn't be. So obviously you want to be here because that's where you are.
And it's perfect because that's what is.
Yeah. And on the one hand, it is so simple.
It's so simple and so hard because it's so much more enjoyable to blame other people for how badly you turned out. First of all, did you turn out badly? That's something worth examining. And secondly, is it somebody else's fault? Because when you blame other people, you render yourself powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah. Now, you come from an interesting background in that context because you're a retired attorney.
I am,
and I'm sure that you ended your career in the sense that, from the perspective as I see it, that my frustration has always been that regardless of what you need an attorney for, especially if you're going, you need one because somebody else has one and you're going to grapple with one another on the courtroom floor, it isn't about justice or the truth. It's about winning today. Doesn't matter whether you were right or wrong, whether you're guilty or innocent. It's whether or not you win. And I have to say that I had a great divorce attorney who had a wonderful slogan on her business cards. And by the way, she is no longer practicing either because she hated the direction things had taken back in the late 90s. But the slogan on her business card was, I love this, reasonable solutions for reasonable people.
Well, it's a fantasy.
Yeah, it is.
Because when people are divorcing, they have a hard time being reasonable.
True.
I really believe it's a form of temporary insanity. the system doesn't do much to encourage reasonableness.
No.
And so.
And she did her best, and I'm grateful for what she did bring to the table. She was a wonderful coach when it came to the deposition that I had to go through. Now I divorced in Arizona, which is a community property state, and we didn't have much community property. We had a house. End of story. We had no other assets, and yet there I was sitting in this deposition, told that I cannot plead the fifth. Which, you know, wouldn't be appropriate anyway, but just to throw a monkey wrench into the thing. But she gave me some coaching that allowed me to walk out of there, even though I felt terrible, to walk out of the deposition, at least knowing that I had done the very best that I could. You know, because there was no winner or loser in that, because we weren't the ones that called the deposition. Her attorney did. But the thing is that this is another one of those stories, even though it's not from my childhood, where what I learned was that I didn't have to be mean and nasty and ugly, and neither was my attorney, in order to accomplish. And I had already set out my goal. I just wanted the divorce. I wanted out. Period. End of story. I didn't want, you know, split this and do that and do the other. I was going to do almost anything. Save, sell my soul, to bring this to a conclusion, because I wanted to move on with my life. It had been going on for way too long. And I think that's what happens with a lot of folks in a lot of situations, is they think that things are permanent.
Right. And I think that if you believe you are a victim and you are simply going to spend your life acting and reacting to what shows up, you believe in the permanency of that because you don't see a way out.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a here's the good news, bad news on taking responsibility for your life being exactly the way it is. The bad news is there's nobody to blame but yourself, and the good news is there's nobody to blame but yourself because. If you created that mess, you can create something way better.
Yeah.
You've just got to believe that it's possible. And we all mess up and we make these huge mistakes. And one of the biggest mistakes is a lot of the time is who we marry. And that's a huge decision. And it we're not using a really good part of our brain when we make the decision, you know? And
well,
getting out is a hell of a lot more difficult than it was getting in.
Yeah, it really is. Well, now that's interesting that you would say that in the same context that we choose our parents. We choose the family in which we come into. Ergo, would it also not stand to reason that we then choose as – I don't know that I would –
Yeah, you chose your spouse.
You chose your spouse
Absolutely.
For certain lessons. And again, I understood where you were coming from before, but I think that as we grow and as we evolve, we begin to understand. I really didn't make any mistakes. What I did was I created learning opportunities, if you will.
Well, that's a very good philosophical way of looking at it. I think it's very hard to believe that at the time when you're dealing with some wild person on the other side. I had clients who were very reasonable, nice people who were married to complete wing nuts who were making their lives a living hell. And what they would do is they would give up everything just to get out. And those were tough, tough situations. To believe that you had called that to you is very, very hard.
Yeah.
But I believe it's absolutely true. And in working with people now as a life strategist and coach, what I see is that people are hiring these new people to play out some aspect of their childhood, usually, that they didn't have resolution around, and they're looking to find resolution with someone similar to a parent. And psychologists will tell you that. I have a psychology degree as well, and I agree that that's part of it. But then, okay, great, well, what are you going to do about it? And so what I help people do is see the sanity of what they were trying to do, that, as you said, it really wasn't a mistake. It was just hellish.
Yeah.
You know, and many of us need to jump off a mountain and land on our noses to learn our lessons. So we keep marrying the same person in different identities. We marry the same set of circumstances and the same personalities until we finally get it. And it's just how we learn here. It's a very fascinating thing, the way that human beings mess up, and out of that comes these brilliant things, like Lorraine Grisky. The reason I included that story was Lorraine Grisky was my nemesis. For no known reason, this girl decided in junior high band that she was always going to stand behind me. I was in the third clarinet section, and right next to the percussion section, and she was going to find a way to crash these cymbals behind my head to try and make me go deaf or scare the hell out of me or something, just because she decided to focus on me. I have never spoken to the girl. She was 2 years older than I was. I had no idea why she chose me or picked me out of the crowd, but she just ceaselessly tortured me. Well, out of that came stories, and Lorraine wasn't gifted beauty-wise, and when I got through describing her to my family every evening, I had blown everything, and everything was hugely exaggerated. I described her as having Buddy Holly glasses and one eyebrow and this horrible ratted-out hair, and some of that was true and some of it was exaggerated, but my goal was to make my parents laugh. I had a very serious, sober father who was from very serious German people. And so the most that you could hope for was to get him to just sort of smile. My mother, on the other hand, she would really, not that all German people aren't fun, I'm just saying, he was a very serious German fellow. And my mother was more Irish and would laugh, and I could get her to have tears rolling down her face, and if I got even a little smirk out of my father, it was a big day. So Lorraine became a gift to my life because I defined my place in the family then as the funny one, the funny storyteller, and that's how I got attention. And so then I would expand it to other people and come home and tell more and more stories. Out of that came what I do, which is, the name of my company is Lighten Up Consulting.
I like that.
My goal is to make people laugh, because when you can laugh about something, it becomes easier to handle, and it changes your body chemistry, and it, now they're finding you can even prolong your life if you intentionally engage in some form of laughter every day.
Couldn't agree with you more on that. I absolutely love watching cartoons and the comedies on television. Now I have to rely on other sources of information to provide me because I don't have network television anymore. I got rid of my dish, and I now use the on-demand services that are available. And I've seen some incredible stuff, documentaries to name a few, just to name one category, and things that I would have never watched before. Now that I can go and scan through stuff and say, oh, you know, that looks kind of interesting. I like the subject. I'm going to watch that, you know, and get a little more education or just have some fun and watch some old comedies, things like that. It's great fun. We're going to come back and talk more, Colleen, about your book and your work and as well as your website. The book entitled Crash Those Cymbals in Hell, Lorraine Grisky. It is Mining My Childhood for Truth, Freedom, and Laughter. And I couldn't agree with her more, especially about the laughter part. And we'll do a little more laughing when we come back here on Tell Me Your Story. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for staying with us as we continue talking with our guest over the phone lines here today, Colleen Miller. Colleen A. Miller, she former attorney. She has a book out called Crash Those Cymbals in Hell, Lorraine Grisky. Mining, Mining My Childhood for Truth, Freedom, and Laughter. And I have to say that there are times in my childhood when it feels like somebody mined my childhood. And I mean with high explosive mines. I went through quite a number of years in school that were not of my real liking. But it is now that time of my life, I suppose, that I have to take a look at those experiences and say, okay, I called those into being for whatever reason. They've made me who I am today. Maybe it's also one of the reasons why I have never been to any of my class reunions, especially high school class reunions, because I got to a point where I said, I just don't want to have anything to do with these knuckleheads. They served their purpose in teaching me a lesson, and the lesson is I don't want to have anything to do with these kind of people. And I have to say, one of the things that really got me, I'd been disconnected from the school system for quite a number of years. I'd been doing these interviews talking about education, but the subject of bullying didn't really come up until early in the 21st century when I'm doing interviews, and we're talking about this, and I'm going, what? You mean this is still this has not been resolved? This hasn't been fixed in the school system. There are still kids who are picking on other kids. What is going on? And then, of course, it dawned on me. The kids I went to school with who were the bullies, who were my bullies, grew up and had children.
They reproduced, don't they?
It's like, oh, my. And it's like, oh, my. And so then I came up with this thought. It dawned on me. And, of course, at the time I was working for a Christian radio station and, you know, a lot of biblical phrases come up, you know, train a child up in the way he should go. And when he gets old, he shall not depart from it. Well, you know what? That has a double meaning, ladies and gentlemen, not just the directive to train a child up, but look at the adult. The adult was trained as a child to be that adult. And that's when it kind of dawned on me, of course. And if they maintain the training, they don't wake up, they don't evolve, if you will, then they pass it on to their children. And it perpetuates. It replicates.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm sure that's what happened to poor Lorraine. I have no idea what her backstory was.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you that Lorraine was a gift to my life. Her bullying was horrible at the time. And I'm not saying that people should turn, you know, bullying into a gift, but if it shows up in your life, what can you make it mean? For me, what I made it mean was at the time, I hated her. I thought she was hideous, and I couldn't understand why she was being mean to me. What I think the overriding arc of my story is this little girl that I was, for whatever reason, took what she was given and made something out of it. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I really like about myself, that you can hand me a pile of doo-doo and I will look for the pony.
You know? Yes, I've
and,
heard that.
I like that about myself. I don't like all of the things about myself, but that I like. And that is that the part of me that is, you know, if we're talking about mythology and hero's journey, where I was heroic was I turned something that could have been terrible into something funny. And when I did that, I could bear it, and I could make it a worthwhile experience, not just a painful, wasted experience because it just hurt. And I think each of us has that hero within us that showed up when we were children. We just didn't recognize it. And to see the overarching themes of our lives and to see what, as human beings, we can endure enormous amounts of struggle, suffering, and pain, and come out the other side in a magnificent way and rise above that is the hero's journey. And we've just lost one of our brightest souls who exemplified that for us.
Yeah, my wife made an interesting comment the other day. She said, that we lost another light worker.
Well, I don't believe he's gone. I believe he's doing his work from the other side now. Mm-hmm. That's what I believe, because he did his work here. But one of the things that I found most heroic about this man was that he could look at what was and not be gulled into believing that's all that could be. He stood in the place of possibility in the face of all of the pain and suffering he endured and that was around him. And the ability to take what you're handed and make something new from it, something worthwhile from it, something more brilliant than what you were given, I believe is an incredible endeavor and worth our time. And it's a way to make this world a different place by shifting our focus and not behaving, not reacting the way that people expect you to react. Lorraine Grisky expected me to react with pain and cowering and that she would finally run me off. Well, I would go home and ask my mother, could you check and see if my ears are bleeding? And I did get out. The story is about me getting out and how my father and I devised a way to get me out of that hideous situation. But out of it came, first of all, a really interesting relationship with my dad, because we lived in a small town, and the music store in our town also sold appliances.
Interesting.
And so I said, Dad, I think that they made me go and practice in this place called the Rec Room, which was this building that was an old garage behind our house that they had turned into a recreation room. My parents owned a motel, and this was a place for gatherings for our tourists. And I believe that thing was haunted, and I hated it. I hated practicing. I was hideous at playing the clarinet. It made the dog howl. That's why they made me go out there to practice. And I hated Lorraine Grisky and that whole band scene. So my father and I devised a plan that we would tell Mama that I was going to sacrifice my wonderful clarinet for the benefit of the whole family if she would let me make the sacrifice that we would use it as a down payment for a dishwasher for her. And she was pretty, I think she caught on, but she was pretty tired of listening to that clarinet squeak. So, and listening to me complain. So my dad and I set this whole thing up, and we traded my clarinet in for a down payment on a dishwasher for the family, but mostly for Mama. And look at all of the, look at everything, all the richness that came from that interaction with Lorraine. But if I had just been a victim and let her bully me, none of that would have come from that.
Yeah. One of the lessons that I learned, it took me quite a long time, unfortunately, to really put it into practice. As long as I gave them the reaction that they wanted, they'd continue. And I did really well in track and field because I learned to run. You know, you could have stayed and fought and gotten beat up, or you could run. And I ran. I said, I'm not willing to deal with this kind of situation. You know, and there were other issues and down through years, but grade school wasn't the funnest, but I still learned some things. I still have some warm memories of certain experiences in grade school and in high school. And I am the person that I am today. And I've actually had some situations where I've had to stand up and say, excuse me, but no, that's not what's going to be happening here. I had a very strange situation happen in a fast food restaurant. I was in line, and this girl, she was wanting to get past me to get to the restroom, and I just turned and I looked down at her, and all of a sudden, from off in the distance, I hear this voice saying, "What did you say to my girlfriend?" And I hadn't said a word, and he just got in my face and everything, and I just looked him square in the face, and I said, "I didn't say anything," and I turned away and got back, stayed in my line, and got my food and moved on. It was another couple of months before I ever went back to that one, but nonetheless, apparently he had been antagonistic towards other people in the place too, because I heard this from the clerk at the front counter. But ordinarily in the past, I probably would have just left. I said, yeah, I'm not even going to deal with this.
Yeah.
But I also wasn't going to let it escalate into something more than it really should have been. I mean, the guy was obviously not quite all there, but nonetheless, you know, I still had the right to stand and say, wait a minute, no, you're hallucinating. I think that that's one of the things too that that we as people in different settings today, you know, you hear the phrase that, well, he doesn't really like confrontation. She doesn't want to, you know, get involved, that kind of stuff. But what I'm seeing more and more people who, it's not that they love confrontation. They don't like the injustice. I think that that's a lot of what's happening these days, is that people are getting fed up. They're not going ballistic, mind you, but they're just getting fed up. And they're saying enough is enough. You step away, you know, step back.
And drawing, yes. Don't you think that you learned a lot about how you were going to show up in situations like that from having experienced what you did in your childhood?
I think that today, I will. Matter of fact, I had a fascinating experience back in 1991. We had just rebuilt the console countertops for both our control room and production room. My boss and I had actually worked together on it. And his instructions were that I was not to move any furniture into any other place unless given permission, you know, gotten permission. And I thought, that's not unreasonable. That's fine. Well, one day I was training a gentleman, and I was also vacuuming, and I had to move some of the furniture. And he showed up at the station, at the transmitter site, and went ballistic. And so, a matter of fact, to the point where I thought he was actually going to hit me. I couldn't sleep for 3 days. I had completely forgotten that, A, I was training this other individual, and B, that I was vacuuming. And of course I'm going to move furniture, but I wasn't going to leave it where it was. I just didn't have a chance to move it back. And it was 3 days later, I called him out to the site, and I said, I haven't been able to sleep for 3 days because of this. And I finally remembered what it was that I was going to say, and then I told him. And he was beyond apologetic. I mean, it was like, you know, he knew that he'd crossed a line big time. Well, back in 2005, with the same gentleman operating a different station, another company had bought a station I was working for and brought the two together. And a situation had occurred between myself and and the chief engineer. So I was called into the office with the new GM and then this gentleman who had done the same thing to me years later, earlier. I sat there in what, you're familiar with open body posture?
Yes.
I sat there in open body posture and I had to do everything to keep from laughing. And this guy was going ballistic like before, like the other one, the other guy did years earlier. Because number one, I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. And number two, I was like, okay, I just have to sit here and let him, I don't take it in, and I just let him vent. And that's why I was trying to keep from laughing, because that's how I saw it. And so that was one of my early experiences with having made that shift. And realizing, hey, I'm okay, you know, and this is all going to just, it's going to blow over and you're not going to, and you'll never hear about it again. But it was so fascinating that I was actually able to play the observer at the same time, realizing, do you realize that you're about to laugh and that's really going to make him even more angry?
Right, but what you did was, that's such a great illustration of this shifting your focus that I was talking about, which is shifting. What we do is when something occurs, we make it about us.
Yes.
And we make it that there's something like Lorraine was being mean to me because there was something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There was something weak or unpowerful or unattractive or unlovable about me. And no, she just had selected me as her victim. And it wasn't about me. Her bullying wasn't about me. It was about her.
Yeah.
And when you're treated badly by people, it is never about you. You are simply the external object of their personal wrath. It's them they're beating up. It's them they hate. Now, that may not be much consolation when you're the one getting thumped on.
Yeah.
But it can bring you to a new place of wisdom where you can say, oh, you know, Mandela and his guard became friends. That guard grew to respect Nelson Mandela for who he continued to show up and be in the face of that level of adversity. That cell was, I think it was 6 feet by 6 feet. That's where he lived for all those years.
Yeah.
And his guard came to admire him, the same one who I'm sure bullied him horribly,
mm-hmm.
because Mandela did not react the way most people would have reacted, with anger and rage and hatred and defensiveness. He simply would not go there.
Now,
and that's the beauty and wisdom of this wonderful, wonderful man, that he said, no, I'm not going to go there, and I'm not going to permit you to treat me, permit you to make me act like you. And that's just such a brilliant, brilliant thing to be able to do. So what you did was you shifted it from, this was all about you, and that's why you couldn't sleep, to, no, this is about him.
Yeah.
And with all due respect, the guy sounds like a wingnut. And
well, and you're not entirely wrong. I tended to develop a pretty quick friendships with people, and I had with this gentleman when he first came out to run the station, and we got along really well. And then all of a sudden, this incident came up, and it's like it unraveled everything. Now, I didn't become his enemy after that. I mean, he dealt with it, and it was over, and we moved on, and we worked together just fine for the remaining period that we were together. But it's very interesting how we do that. I mean, you talk about, maybe this is one of the reasons why I am not a fan anymore of a lot of the dramas, whether they be television or movies. Action adventure is a different thing for me. Okay. I know what's going on there as well, but I guess it's because in these dramas that I'm seeing, it's playing out the same stories. I'm tired of this. I'm tired of these stories because I know where it's going.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's predictable. And yet there are many people who still enjoy those stories. That's fine. But I'm not one of them. I love the cartoons. And I tell you what, I go in knowing they're stupid. I like Family Guy. I like The Simpsons. You know, I like those kinds of cartoons. I go in knowing they're stupid, but they make me laugh. And they're poking fun at everybody. They're not picking on one group of people. Everybody is the target, you know. And sometimes I'm the target because of some of the things that they might say. But I laugh because it's, you know, it what was it? You used the phrase, or used the aspect of adding more years to your life. I have to outlive my great grandmother. Now, my great grandmother lived to be 100 years of age. I'm only 53, and I got a long way to go.
For her.
Well, I didn't think so when she was in her 90s and kept going, and I was telling people I was going to outlive her, but she's making it really hard, you know.
I know, right?
But
these tough old birds.
Oh my gosh! And I'm grateful for that lesson as well. I mean, she was a wonderful woman and raised an incredible family, I was lucky enough even to have a chance to. I even interviewed her once. She and her husband came from Italy and all this kind of stuff, but. The lessons that I have learned from family, I mean, haven't been back to a family reunion in quite a while, but those that I'd been to, it's just extraordinary to see the growth of people, whether it's just their careers or otherwise, doesn't matter. But just to see the fact that they're making the changes and the shifts and they're growing and they're moving forward and having more kids. I mean, my gosh, I never thought I would be an uncle, let alone a great uncle, really? And so we have four generations living. And I even thought about my great niece and wondered, is she going to be subject to the same stuff that I went through? Or is she going to be able to grow up in a world that's better, that's more, shall I say, well adjusted?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. And I believe so, I hope so, but it's up to her to make it what it needs to be to please her. Do you know about the work of a woman named Byron Katie?
Name doesn't ring a bell. Tell me.
Well, she wrote a book about loving what is, and she said that her pain and her suffering in her life was caused by her arguing with reality. And what she meant by that is the consensus reality. And that you can argue with reality and you will only lose 100% of the time.
She sounds like my twin sister.
And so, yeah. And so what she's saying is, if you sit and argue with how things are, you're going to be miserable and suffer and be in pain. If you can embrace how they are and what you would rather have them be instead of making that reality wrong, you can have a different experience of your life. So will there be a world without bullying and unkindness and suffering? I don't know, because this is a world of contrast.
Mm.
And in order to have the peace and grace and kindness and unconditional love that we all seek, the opposites must also be here. But can we choose to express from that positive, gracious, loving, kind place? Can more and more of us do that? You bet. And that's what I think that light workers are up to. They're saying critical mass is not a very high number. If you have something, I think in the world of 7 billion, 8 million people focused in one direction, you can create critical mass. It's not very many.
That is not, by comparison to what the population is, you're right. It is not that many.
And so by simply saying, I'm going to quit arguing with what is, I'm going to quit saying it's wrong, I'm simply going to focus on what I'd rather have instead, what I'd rather see instead, the peace that I want to see, Gandhi said, be the peace you're looking to create in the world. So if you can find that, but it's about being in that peaceful, loving place at the Thanksgiving table or the Christmas dinner table where your relatives are driving you nuts. And it's because you believe they should be different from how they are.
Yeah.
And I haven't achieved that, but it's a goal where I can look at my family and go, this is exactly the way it's supposed to be.
But wait a minute, you wrote this book and these stories. I thought you had this all figured out.
Well, I try to live it, but sometimes
I know.
Have to tell you that what is beautiful is that my children are starting to repeat this back to me and my grandchildren.
Uh-oh.
And I am, I am being bombed by my own, it's friendly fire.
Isn't the phrase hung by your own petard?
That is exactly right. And it's so wonderful because it's, oh my gosh, they were listening.
Yeah.
So when I fall off the wagon, there's someone to go, hey, Mom, you want to walk your talk? Hey, Mom, what was that you were just doing? And I'm going, this is brilliant. It's wonderful because they were paying attention. I believe that's the way that we can make a difference in the world, that your niece and your grandniece, is it your grandniece?
My grandniece, uh-huh.
She can be that difference that she's looking to make by simply focusing on what's possible, what's positive, what's funny, what is the perfection of that which is around her, which is very hard when there's tremendous suffering. And there always, always are gifts. You know, I heard people in New Jersey talk about all of the horrors of Sandy. And they also talked about the communities that came together and the people they hadn't seen. We just had floods in Colorado. And people got in touch with us we hadn't heard from in years, literally 10, 15 years. Mm. People in these communities have pulled together and they're rebuilding the communities. That's all there, and it shows up, and that's a part of the story, too. You know, and I don't mean to sound like a goody two-shoes, but it really is there, these people standing up and saying, wait a minute, we can rebuild this.
Yeah.
And standing by each other and doing these amazing acts of random kindness that they didn't do the day before.
Exactly, exactly. Well, I don't want a time to run out before we let people know they can look for your book at a lot of different places, including lightenupconsulting.com, and they can also get in touch with you at Colleen@lightenupconsulting.com. And before we do get to the end of our time together, I have a few final questions for you. Who is Colleen Miller?
Oh, gosh, I wish I knew. Well, my husband says he never ceases to be tired bored coming home because I'm always somebody new. I think who I am is someone who is seeking to make a difference in some little way that I can, that the world is a little bit better because I'm here. I hope that's what I'm about. Hope that's who I am. And I'm also somebody who really loves to laugh and be a five-year-old child.
Mm.
It's a really good reason to have grandchildren, I'm telling you right now.
Oh, yeah.
Those grandnieces and grandnephews are great because they give you an excuse to act five.
Well, I have to get started then because I don't have any kids yet, but be that as it may, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want people to lighten up the loads, the burdens they're carrying through working with someone. I work with people, but find someone you can trust and go and re-examine the loads and burdens you're carrying and see if you can't lighten those up a little.
Mm.
And see if you can't look at your world and find the funny. Mine your lives for the funny. When you do that, you create all these fantastic endorphin-type hormones in your body. You ward off disease. People who are happy and laughing don't create war.
Yeah, yeah. Crash Those Cymbals in Hell, Lorraine Grisky and Colleen Miller. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program.
And I want to thank you for creating this program so people have an opportunity to talk about the work they're doing in the world. Thank you for doing that.
Well, you're quite welcome.
And I know those programs are a lot of work. So.
They are, and they're also a lot of fun.
But thank you for your work and your intention in making the world better.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. We want to let people know that if they want to get in touch with you, Colleen at lightenupconsulting.com and also the website, lightenupconsulting.com, and people can go there and find out more about what you do and how you can be involved in their lives and supporting them and hopefully making them laugh as well. I'm Richard Dugan, and this has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we certainly hope that you will dream big, start, even if it is a small dream, and who knows where it will propel you to in the coming weeks, months, and years. Until the next time we're together, love to Lal.